It being Wednesday, it is time, as usual, to turn our attention to issues up valley. I want to, first of all, before we begin with Carolyn Martini, I want to thank Eric Sklar for being kind enough today to relinquish his time that he was going to spend with me during this hour so that I could spend time with Carolyn Martini, a member of the St. Helena School Board, to talk about some of the many, many issues that have been swirling around the school board and the possible recall up there. Carolyn, first of all, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome.
Appreciate you being here and, participating in a continuing and what I suspect will be an ongoing discussion about this issue. But before we get into this, I want to talk a little bit about you. Tell us a little bit about how long you've been on the school board, why you ran originally. Give us a little bit of background.
Well, I originally ran 5 years ago now in a special election like the one we're currently having, over a board member who left the area, and then there was an open spot, and the citizens petitioned to have a special election rather than appoint somebody.
Right.
So I ran and won.
All right. And obviously, to get involved in this, it's not for the vast sums of money that come. It's because you cared, because there was something in the job and in the school system up there that you were interested in. Talk a little about that.
Well, I mean, I've always been interested in education and the process of how people get educated, and I was born in St. Helena, and I went through those schools, and so it seemed to me that given that I had an opportunity, an open space in my life, so to speak, it was time to go back and see what had become of the schools and what was happening. You know, generally, California doesn't have a particularly good reputation right now for their public schools, so I wanted to see if what was happening.
Mm-hmm. And when you got in there, when you got into office and started going to meetings and started learning more about the schools up there, what did you find? What impressions did you come away with? And how was it different than the way you remembered it from when you were there?
Well, when I was there, which is, you know, ancient history now, California was number one in the nation in its schools, at least for their kids getting out, being able to get into college, that type of thing. We're now like 48th. So St. Helena probably has suffered less than schools in general, I think because of the wealth of the district. So we have a higher percentage of very good teachers, and we can pay them better. And so that keeps the jobs attractive. We don't have to go scrambling quite as hard, and we have more choice. So I think in general that it was in okay shape, but it needed more cohesiveness at that time. And at the time that board member seat changed over, we were also hiring. They'd gone out to do a search for a recruitment for a new superintendent, because the one they'd had been interim for about 4 years.
Right.
And when he came on board, that would be Alan Gordon, when he came on board, then most of the administration turned over, so he was able to put in place people he'd known and worked with before and had a track record.
Uh-huh.
So we were kind of lucky in getting I've called them a dream team. I know other people don't agree, but I think they are.
Two parts to that. One, first of all, do you think that there was any danger, I mean, it's probably too strong a word, but anything to be concerned about as a board member in having a superintendent come in and put all of his people in place, essentially wiping out the kind of institutional memory that might have been there on the one hand, and two, really having people that whose first loyalty was more to him than even to the board?
Well, except that you don't turn over your teacher base, and that's where your institutional memory is. Because when you have some of the older teachers that we had in place that were, I mean, dearly loved, and you know, a few of them, say like Bruce Frank was still there,
uh-huh.
and people like that, that's where the memory comes in. It's just like elective offices in some places, like the president comes and goes, but the heads of all those bureaus stay in place.
Well, talk a little bit about what you thought was holding St. Helena back. You know, you said, you know, it certainly had more money, it had a lot of things going for it, but it really was not living up to its potential. That was sort of the implication of what you were saying. What do you think was holding it back?
Well, holding it back sounds like I think it was a negative. I don't. I think St. Helena was ahead of the curve even then. But if you have all the advantages that we have, and a lot of that is not just money, a lot of that is a very interested community. We have a parent base up there in both our Anglos and Hispanics who are very dedicated to education. And we have people who are willing to come into the schools and help out, whether it's show kids on their telescopes or take them through their recently built medieval town up on the hill or whatever it is. We have people who want to interact with the kids. So that's a huge, huge resource. And what I had found when I first got involved there was that the schools had allowed themselves to become kind of insular. So the community, St. Lynn has always been proud of its schools, and the schools have the potential of being the center of that community. And they had kind of lost that a little bit. They were, these people that were running the schools were not interacting with all of the town folk, just little groups that they could kind of get their hands on. So when Gordon came, one of the main things he did was to start reaching out to all kinds of groups of people and start a strategic planning session and start, you know, facilities planning committees with people who are going to be willing to give money. Well, you know, come sit and see what we can do and so forth and so on. So it spreads an understanding of what the schools are trying to do. And that was not there before.
Given that, and all of that sounds great, but given everything that you just said, and it's a good sort of lead-in to some of the issues of today, that there is an engaged parent population, that there was a history before, you know, you got there, before Alan Gordon got there, and in previous regimes, there was this history of insularity and a sense of being disconnected from the community. And given that, that you understood that and really worked during, you know, your tenure there to try and change that, why was it that you and your colleagues on the board were not more sensitive to the community with respect to the decision to put Rob Haley in place without recruitment, without a search, even when there was significant voices in the community, over 60 I know that spoke up specifically, I mean, and certainly far beyond that, to do something beyond just doing this essential midnight appointment of Rob Haley?
Well, I don't know about a midnight appointment, but I was listening to the voices. I know they don't think so, but it's true, I was. And if you're going to condemn a person for something, you need to come forward with something that's specific. It's not just, I don't like him. And that was all we were getting. And so there wasn't any reason, because you have 60 people that are unhappy, maybe we have 5,700 that aren't. So this is not, you need to listen to what they're saying, but if they want to overcome this,
they need
to be able to come up with some evidence or something that there's something wrong. I didn't see it.
But that's with respect to Rod Haley. But look at it in the context of the larger issue. Not whether Rob Haley was the right person or not. He may very well be the right person. But the idea of not doing a search, not considering other people, not listening to other voices in terms of exploring other options. I mean, Rob Haley was essentially appointed, 48 hours after Alan Gordon officially resigned. Why not look to see who else might have been out there and still maybe chosen Rob Haley?
I come out of a business background, and you normally wouldn't do that. You would go to the outside if you didn't have somebody coming up that was in a position to do a good job who you thought fit that slot next. My mind, I always thought that Rob would probably be the best choice for the job, so I didn't have any problem with the decision to hire him. Wasn't done at midnight, was done over a long period of time. I mean, by the time we got done, it took 2 months to hire him.
But essentially, the decision was made late at night in private session.
I must not have been there, so I don't know.
you were not there at that meeting. Finish your thought. I interrupted you. In terms of why not looking beyond? I mean, we know.
Well,
I mean,
you put the brakes on everything you're doing then. We had some great momentum going with the teachers, with this IB coming in. We just had our first audit for IB. They were very happy about how we were doing with all of this. And And what you want to do is the guy who started it and was implementing it was Rob. And so you wanted to continue that whole momentum as much as possible. So even if you stopped everything, you make him interim, everybody waits. Okay? So there's no changes in personnel and there's no filling positions, thinking about what they're going to do, worrying about, they're all sitting there worrying about, are we going to have IB when we come back? Is it going to be a new guy that's going to want something different? So you've basically stopped something you've just started. Very, very bad thing to do if you're trying to get something, the momentum going on something as important as that.
Except that it's not a private business. And in public institutions, oftentimes the process goes slower. It's very frustrating. It's frustrating to those of us that watch the way public institutions work. But there is a greater responsibility to the public and even to the minority, even if it's 66 people that represent, you know, 6,600 maybe, and maybe there are more that feel, you know, good about the other side. There is that greater responsibility and a sense of frustration on the part of people not being heard. One of the things that...
How do you convince somebody that they are not heard? If you don't agree with them and you do something differently, how do you convince them that they are not heard?
Because you go through the process, and you might have hired Rob Haley at the end of that process and done exactly what you think was the best thing to do, but certainly it could have been a more public and more transparent process with the same result.
Okay, it's a matter of opinion.
Well, I mean, certainly, do you believe that the process that you engaged in was a public and transparent process?
Yeah.
Tell me how so.
Because we went through all the steps. It was posted in a meeting. It was discussed. And
Jim Haslip said here last week when he was here with Eric that he had specifically requested of Inez de Luna an agenda item to discuss a search. He was said he was shut down. He was denied that as an agenda item, that both Inez de Luna and Cynthia Lane specifically would not let him do that. I just want to get your response to that.
I don't know. I don't know what kind of a conversation he had with them.
Well, he says this was at a meeting. This was public.
If it was, it was like after the meeting. It wasn't during the meeting. Can we find it in the minutes?
I haven't looked through the minutes. I'm asking you to respond to what Jim Haslip said here last week. As I say, this was a conversation he had with Eric Sklar last week. I've listened to it several times, and I'm just asking you to respond to it.
I am not aware that happened at a public meeting. I know when we were discussing Haley at both the open meetings and in a closed session, that Haslip was his best advocate. He was very, very much for hiring Dr. Haley. And he also told the paper that, because I went with him that day to the paper and we had that discussion. And then something changed his mind, so he quit.
Well, I mean, he is a different version of it. Which sort of leads me to another question as we sort of move down the line on some of these issues, and we'll talk a little bit about the contract, about the PARS deal, and about that, how that proceeded. Jim Haslip said last week that he specifically, in a meeting with you specifically, expressed to you and to Rob Haley his frustration, his disappointment with the way the process had gone down with respect to the retirement package, the PARS package, for Alan Gordon. Comment on that?
I think that, I heard the tape from last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought what he was referring to was when he and I were talking to Alan, and Alan was explaining what he meant, what the PARS package was, how it worked, and what it meant. And Jim hadn't understood that. He thought it was like a payout bonus sort of thing, over, you know, like a one chunk deal, and when Gordon explained that, no, instead of salary, I get 1 year's salary spread over 5 years, and in exchange for that, I'm willing to keep working on some of these projects, Jim thought it was a great idea.
Well, he says,
and Jim accepted exactly the same deal for Jim Zoll, so it's not quite consistent. If
I think
which,
there are
which is I, you know, I don't know. That's Jim.
Well, I know, but I, you know, the he made some points, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond. I mean, he claims that he specifically said in that meeting with you that he was concerned that it would be perceived as a gift of public funds.
If it was handed to him as the whole thing, that he didn't, it seemed to me that he didn't understand that this wasn't just like a check goodbye. Uh-huh. That this was overtime. So instead of salary, this was overtime split up. And in return, Gordon, well, the deal for everybody was they basically got this and they went away, so they didn't have to work. Gordon was willing to stay on for that.
He had already said he would do those projects for free.
Well, this is basically doing them for free because he could have taken the package and not done the project.
Well, but he had already said he would do the work for free. So suddenly saying that he was taking the $180,000 to do the work.
I think he said he would do the work.
He said he would do the work long before he said he would get paid for it.
He said he would like to be involved in the projects and so forth.
Mm-hmm. But essentially he did say he would do it for free.
He said he would do it, and he would take the PARS package.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about the PARS package and whether or not you perceive there to be any conflict of interest with the way that had proceeded.
I did not see it that way.
Tell me why.
I have a website that's sthschoolboard.org. People want to look because I posted all of the PDF file of all of the backup information for the decisions that were made during that year concerning PARS. And essentially the board had voted back in September that we wanted to do a PARS package that year.
Uh-huh.
Then PARS is a private organization which designs these things with the school. So in this case, we were including all accredited or credentialed people. Okay,
uh-huh.
So that's teachers and administrators. The teacher section of it then has to be negotiated with the union so that they're happy that the teachers are protected. And that was done. And, of course, the part for credentialed administrators does not because they don't have a representation.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So when that was all done, we voted on it. And we also reserved the right that if it didn't save the school money, the district money over time, or even immediately, that we could rescind it. And all of that was worked out and worked, and Gordon signed it.
Uh-huh.
Gordon is the plan administrator.
Uh-huh.
This is very normal. Usually your CEO is your plan administrator.
But in this case, he was a potential beneficiary of
but
the plan.
Not at the time he worked it out. He was thinking, this was in like before Christmas, say. And there wasn't anything going on before Christmas about him retiring that year. He had another year on his contract.
But he had told people as recently as December of 2008 that he was thinking of retiring.
My dad told us that. I don't know how many times. It took us 5 tries to get him out of there. I mean, very often people who are getting near that point in their life will talk to their team and say, you know, when I retire, or I'm thinking of retiring next year, or I'm thinking of what would we see going forward.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, that's what I took it to be. Uh-huh. I didn't think it was imminent. I thought he meant at the end of his contract he wouldn't re-up.
Uh-huh. But he had made it clear to quite a number of people that he was looking at retirement sooner than that.
Okay. Didn't do it to me.
Uh-huh. Even if it wasn't going to be instantly, the fact that he would benefit from this package created a potential conflict of interest.
Why would he benefit? He doesn't get paid $222,000. He gets paid $36,000.
Uh-huh. But he's still benefiting from it. He's still getting from it.
He's getting a year less contract. He's getting some more free time.
And he is getting money from a deal that he negotiated. I mean, the whole idea of conflict of interest is built around the fact that you don't negotiate or sign agreements or participate in agreements that you can have any monetary benefit from.
Except that it wasn't negotiated with his retirement in mind. If he had gone back after he had decided to retire or gave Inez the letter and then said, can we change the conditions on this so that I can get more money out of it? That's a conflict of interest. If he signs it as the plan administrator in the normal course of business and then later on that year says, I'm going to retire now, can I take this? Everybody said yes.
But the problem is that that's not what the law says. That's the problem, Carolyn. Let me read you something.
Well, that's what the lawyer said.
Well, but let me read you something, and I'm going to take a few minutes to do this because I think it is sort of central to this whole issue, and I would love you to comment on it. The sort of definitive case law on this issue is a case, People v. Honig, about conflicts of interest. And let me read you something from the decision in that case. And this will take a couple of minutes, but I think it's worth it. Case says, the conflict of interest statutes are based upon the truism that a person cannot serve two masters simultaneously, which is regarded as a self-evident truth as trite and impregnable as the law of gravitation. The duties of public office demand the absolute loyalty and undivided, uncompromised allegiance of the individual that holds the office. Yet it is recognized that an impairment of impartial judgment can occur even in the most well-meaning men when their personal economic interests are affected by the business they transact on behalf of the government. Consequently, our conflict of interest statutes are concerned with what might have happened rather than merely what actually happened. They are aimed at eliminating temptation, avoiding the appearance of impropriety, and assuring the government of the officer's undivided and uncompromised allegiance. Their objective is to remove or limit the possibility of any personal influence, either directly or indirectly, which might bear on an official's decision. In view of the purposes of our conflict of interest statutes, it is well established that their scope is not limited to instances of actual fraud, dishonesty, unfairness, or loss to the governmental entity, and criminal responsibility is assessed without regard to whether the contract in question is fair or oppressive. Thus, it has been repeatedly held that such matters are irrelevant under Section 1090 of the Code. In enacting the conflict of interest provisions, the legislature was not concerned with the technical terms and rules applicable to the making of contracts, but instead sought to establish rules governing the conduct of government officials. Accordingly, those provisions cannot be given a narrow and technical interpretation that would limit their scope and defeat the legislative purpose. It goes on to cite some cases. Thus, where a member participated in preliminary matters leading to the adoption of a contract but resigned before the formal award of the contract, the court refused to construe the word made in a narrow and technical sense, and instead held that it encompassed the planning, preliminary discussions, compromises, drawing of plans, specifications, and solicitation of bids, etc., etc. It's pretty clear that even if there was the possibility in the most remote way that he could derive economic benefit, then even as a technicality, he couldn't have signed the contract.
Well, the lawyer should have told him that. Did they?
I don't know. What did the lawyers tell the board members?
That was that if you wanted to take the same. My understanding, which is always, is that if he wanted to take the same agreement that had been extended, you know, no changes or anything, there wasn't any problem with that.
Yeah, well.
And so that's, you know, that's what makes horse races is something. I think this has all been turned over to the DA to look into.
Right. And okay. That is.
Well, that's their job. It's not
that,
my job.
That is taking its course. But can you understand, given these issues that we've talked about, these two primary issues, the way Rob Haley was appointed and this issue that we've been talking about, can you understand the frustration that some people feel in the community and why this has become such a divisive issue?
I can understand that people get unhappy for whatever reason, and then a cause presents them an ability to act on that unhappiness. There's always a conflict with parents and schools because the parent is the child's advocate and that one child's advocate, and the school has to think of all 1,400 kids, and those things don't always mesh.
Uh-huh. Do you think that the board could have acted in any way that would have accomplished all of its objectives, all of its desires in this case, the appointment of Rob Haley, the retirement package, moving Jim Zoll out, all of the things that were accomplished here, do you think that the board could have done those things in a way that might have been more sensitive, for lack of a better word, to the desires of the community and might have in some way averted?
First of all, I think it would be good if we didn't refer to the whole community of St. Helena as being what's going on here. But as far as those parents are concerned, I don't know how the problem is you don't know how to identify people who are going to have a problem with something before you go through the steps. Like if we go through normal business, no one shows up at meetings, nobody ever complains about everything. We go through normal, most of the stuff is boilerplate uh-huh. that you do at these meetings sure. and so forth anyway. So you set that up, you go by, they've always seemed to me to be extremely careful about setting things up according to way the regulations have to be and doing the open session items and the closed session items and telling us over and over again about the things we can talk about and the things we can't talk about. So all of a sudden out of the wherever comes people who are dissatisfied with the process for one reason or another. And I don't know what all their core reasons are. I mean, I don't know who these groups, the centers of what their core issues are, but they find a comradeship. And so then that allows them to start a movement like this. Well, how did we know before the fact who to communicate with? Mm-hmm. How would we know that this specific person, that specific person, that specific person is going to have a problem with Dr. Haley or with the way the board decided to do something before we did it or before they ever showed up at a meeting? Let's put it that way.
But you knew from, you know, let's just take the 66 people that we know expressed displeasure at Dr. Haley. We know that there was a group of people in the community and that those 66 probably represented more. I don't know how many more. It's not,
or
you
not.
Know, I'm not going to do a
you
mathematical model.
Or not, you don't know.
Well, true. But we can assume that they certainly represented more and that was something that you heard that was an issue out there.
And I listened to them. And I didn't hear anything that was evidence of anything that would prevent him from doing a very good job. That's all. I personally listened to what they said at the board meetings, read all the stuff in the paper, read the emails going around, but I didn't see anything in there. There were no charges presented at that time. There was nothing there that was anything more than I don't like him. Uh-huh. And that's not enough for me.
Let's talk a little bit about another issue that has come up in all of this is the salaries in general that are paid, the administrative salaries that are paid in St. Helena, and whether or not they are simply too high in the views of a lot of people. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I have another little piece on that on the website. I don't think they're too high if you consider... Well, first of all, in the article on the website, there's a bracket of schools who are similar to us in size and districts, basic aid districts and so forth, and we're in the same range. Uh-huh. According to the teachers' union's rule of thumb is twice your top paid teacher is the superintendent's salary, and they watch that pretty carefully because, of course, money going to the superintendent's not going to them. So I think in our case, that's around $206,000.
Well, the superintendent's salary is $264,000 with benefits.
That superintendent, this one's now, is $189,000.
Mm-hmm. Well, more with benefits. There's another $30,000 or so in benefits on top of that, and that's still taxpayers' money. So it's, it's about $220,000, $230,000, something like that. You know, is that the right amount? Is $94,000?
Well,
I'm looking at this breakdown here. Is $94,000 for the superintendent's secretary, you know, the right number? Is $156,000 for the assistant superintendent the right number?
$110,000 for a teacher the right number? Is $55,000 for a starting teacher the right number?
Well, we're talking about administrators here.
Or teachers. How about the janitor? I mean, I don't know. What are you going to compare it to?
Well,
you don't want to compare it to private business. Private business was paying on considerably less revenue was paying a salary more than that 10 years ago.
Well, I'm not I'm not sure that that's the case in 2009.
It's a matter of opinion. You pay what you need to pay to get the talent you want. And if you want the very best talent, the competition is there. I mean, the competition is going to be up in those price brackets, is what I'm trying to say. There isn't a huge amount of that talent out there. There's not, with the boomers starting to retire out, there is simply not a whole lot of up-and-coming top superintendents, top teachers.
So superintendents...
So I think all of their salary bases should probably go up.
So you think that superintendents who are being paid quite a bit less in non-basic aid districts, in ADA districts, where there isn't as much money to go around and superintendents are being paid less, is the argument that those people are not as talented as the ones being paid $260,000?
Last time I checked, it was still a capitalist country. You don't have to take the job if you don't like the pay. So people are willing to take those jobs at those prices, and someone is willing to hire them, whatever their talent base is. You know perfectly well that all people aren't equal. And you had someone in Gordon who was at the end of his career, very well respected in the whole job classification, mm-hmm. had to be recruited, didn't come up voluntarily to apply for the job. And if the board at that time paid him more than was scale, I don't know. But I don't think these are out of line for what we're asking these people to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you understand, and maybe not, I mean, do you understand the community's or some members of the community's frustration when they see this level of salary? And what might upset them about it?
Well, on a more generic basis, I think people, the numbers sound big because a lot of employees look at their own paychecks and they say, you know, my paycheck is, I'm only taking home $800 a month, so it's 800 times 12. And they forget the 30% the employer is putting in for their bennies. And so they're actually getting paid more than that. So they're doing something, whatever this job skill is. They don't know what this job skill is. And so could they do this job? No. So the comparison for judgment is always their own comfort zone. And they don't know what these jobs are. Or the responsibility for them, or the grief the people take, or whatever else, and a lot of people wouldn't be willing to change. But it sounds like a lot of money.
Okay, let's talk about one other issue, and I think this is the last central one that has come up in these discussions of late, and this is something Jim Haslip raised here last week with Eric, and that I want to ask you about, and I know you've addressed this issue in terms of responses to constituents, and it's come up before the board. And that is the argument about programs that have been cut in the district, particularly in the occupational area. Talk a little about that.
Well, I actually have the little flyer they put out, and then I have our fact sheet, so that's for you.
Okay.
What's really happened is that, let's say in olden days, when I was in school in olden days, they had a wood shop and they had an auto shop and they had some of these various programs in place. The whole state of California went through a period where this wasn't in style anymore. And so the funds for those programs dried up to the extent that areas kept them. They kept them because of local pressure. And not all that long ago, the local pressure in St. Helena, the citizens raised the money and built the ag facility and made a deal with the school to hire the ag teacher so that we could have an ag program again. They would not have put that in if the community hadn't forced that one in. Okay, so now what we're trying to do is we're trying to get career tech. Governor Schwarzenegger likes career tech because he's a European and they do a lot of that kind of stuff. And he has money for career tech where there isn't money for other programs. So what we would like to do is recreate these, but recreate them in the modern model. So if you're going to be teaching woodshop, you're going to be teaching the programmable cutters and all of this kind of stuff. And we don't have the money to get the equipment right now until we get grants maybe for this. Instead of doing home ec, you do culinary arts. And you tie in this valley, my Lord, you tie in with CIA and some of the restaurants and whatever else. And to make it even more, to give it more power, we can run one of my aspirations would be to have them run a certification program using some of these online courses from the university and what all else, so that a kid coming out of St. Helena High School in food tech or whatever they're going to call it, culinary, has his food safety handling certificate already. He's going to be able to walk into a restaurant or any food handling plant and get a job over every other high school graduate in line, because they know he knows what he's doing already. So all these things should be incorporated in the career tech. And that's, it's just finding a place to do them. Like, for instance, I know that I just had a tour out there of the old wood shop. They've cleaned it all up. They've gotten as much new machines as they can, and they have to get safety guards and stuff and things that never used to be used. They got to put on the saws now, all this stuff. So you can teach the kids not to stick their fingers in them. But the career tech is modeled after what you're supposed to have an emphasis on the types of jobs which are available in your area, which obviously means viticulture and enology, the hospitality business, which is where culinary fits in. And so what we're looking is that the question that Gordon asked the teachers is if they're in a any kind of anything, drama, music, the video classes, any of this stuff. Can St. Helena's kids come out with an edge in the entry-level market in this field? Then you have a career tech path. And you have to define a path and all the curriculum that goes with the path in order to get to access this money, these grants. So that's what we're in the process of doing now, is having everybody from the drama person, you know, can this person learn how to build sets? Is that something that is a transferable skill when they get out of here? Culinary is an obvious one. They got a wood shop and a metal shop under the ag program. Viticulture, of course, they do horticulture to the extent that they have the flowers and they do the flower arranging and that kind of thing. But the continuation of this is they've just finished this nature trail at RLS, and the International Baccalaureate program works kindergarten through fifth grade, 6-10. So I would like them to. I'm saying this is not. I would really like to see the career tech started in sixth grade, so that by the time kids even get to high school, they're beginning to have an idea of things they really liked to do, things that were outside of just the general academic stream, so that there's more variation there. If we come up with kids that have a background, have all the fundamentals down, and a little bit of advanced time in high school to do some of the advanced work in that, then it's going to lead to the development of better trade schools out there for kids. And since 75% of your kids don't go to college in this country, we really need a strong trade route for them.
And what has to happen in order for that career tech program to be in place? It sounds like you're saying the issue is money.
No, well, it's rerouting the money, and it's time. It's figuring out who's going to teach what, where are we at it, do we need another teacher here or over here? How do we get it started at the junior high? Who's going to go down there and teach those classes? Who's going to back them up? And so it's a logistical thing. It's a curriculum thing. It's fitting it into IB so that the whole thing works smoothly, so that the you don't want fits and starts, and you want the kids to be able to see a logical continuum.
And is the money there for this program if the time is there to make it all piece together?
I think the money would be there in some of these grants. Some of the grants now are for buildings, but I think there's money out there that you can access for programs or for equipment, say, for programs.
One of the issues that Jim Haslip raised last week is that if some of the money was freed up from all these administrative costs, that it might make more money available for these programs.
Well, the problem with those arguments is that you always have to go through and specifically identify the administrative costs you'd get rid of, and then figure out how you're going to replace that person or job. Because presumably they're not just standing there getting a salary, they're doing something. So you got to make sure you got all your bases covered before you start hacking and sawing.
Or lower the salary. I mean, the money that's being paid to Jim Zoll and to Alan Gordon to do nothing, essentially, is well, I mean, that was part of Jim Haslip's argument.
Well, I know, but they didn't do nothing.
All right. How do you, before we wrap it up, tell me how you think that this is all going to play out, and what are your final thoughts on all of this right now?
Well, I mean, I'm not necessarily happy about spending the extra money on the special elections, but I think that that's the right way to go, because I found in from both sides of the issue, I found that running through a special election myself, you learn a ton about what it is exactly you're supposed to be representing, and then being on the board, if whoever wins gets on the board, that's an education. So. I'm happy to have them go at it for the special election. As far as the recall is concerned, again, that's up to the community. I mean, we get there in whenever this happens, and we get voted up or down. And I'm not sure there's a big campaign involved in that.
All right. Well, we'll see how it all plays out. Carolyn, I thank you so much for coming in. Carolyn Martini, member of the St. Helena Unified School Board, thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it.